From Python Import Podcast is brought to you by lolcats and pandas sneezing.
Code monkey, get up, get coffee. Code monkey, go to job. Code monkey, have boring meeting with boring manager Rob. Rob say code monkey, very diligent, but his output stink. His code not functional or elegant, what do code monkey think?
Hello, and welcome to From Python Import Podcast. My name is Mike Piernot, and I'm hanging out in the backyard with...
Mike Kroot.
Hi, Mike Kroot.
Hi, Mike Piernot. So, what's this episode about?
Well, we were down at PyOhio a couple weekends ago.
Wait, what's PyOhio?
PyOhio is a... Wow, there's an airplane going over the sky. Perfect. Let's record the podcast intros outside in Mike's yard. That'll be a great idea. Sure, brilliant.
No way this could go wrong. You know, I'm actually really paranoid about the whole blue ice thing now that I saw the Mythbusters.
They had this problem on Lord of the Rings, because their studio was in a converted warehouse down by the airport, and they had planes flying over. So, like, every couple of minutes they had to stop filming to let the deafening plane roar go overhead, and then they could be Lord of the Ringsing again. Anyway.
So, what's this episode about?
Well, a couple of weeks ago we were hanging out down at PyOhio.
Wait, what's PyOhio?
PyOhio is a regional mini PyCon that's held every summer near the end of July, usually it's the last weekend in July, in Columbus, Ohio. And draws folks from all over Ohio and the surrounding regions, as well as some exciting folks from out of town, from the both east and west coasts, and we had some Canadian friends join us as well. And it's a free conference, so all you gotta do is get there, and then
but
get
in. How's the talk?
Talks are outstanding, and I'm actually really excited about this interview because we had some of my favorite speakers from the conference agree to all sit down together and have a conversation with us.
Who are they?
So we've got James Tauber, who was keynoting. You may know him from such projects as PinX and Habitualist.
Ah, the Django guy.
Yeah, among other things. He had a lot of cool stuff to show off in his keynote that melted our brains. We've got Kenneth Reitz, who is the author of Requests, which
Ooh,
is my
hero.
Yeah, my hero. Praise be to Requests. And as well as like a million other open source things that he's releasing all the time. It's really crazy. Also a really talented photographer, so it's fun to hang out and talk photos with him.
He had
as
some
a
pretty
fellow
awesome
Shutterbug.
Shot.
Yeah, yeah. So his stuff up on Flickr is really great. And we had Chad Whitaker, who's the creator of Aspen, the web framework, as well as the founder of GitTip. Probably people have seen GitTip in the news, or they've seen it on the interwebs or the Twitters already. But and he'll explain that in our conversation, what it's all about and how it came to be.
Our listeners should probably check that out, too.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So with that, should we... Uh-oh, here comes another airplane. Recording in the backyard is a really dumb idea. Let's not do this again. Hello, and welcome back to From Python Import Podcast. My name is Mike Piernot. I'm here with Mike Kroot and David Stanek, as well as some illustrious guests from the Python community. Who all do we have here?
My name is Kenneth Reitz, and I work for Heroku, and I write a lot of open source stuff that you might be familiar with.
Such as?
Requests, TabLive, HTTP, bin, a bunch of stuff.
Okay.
I'm James Tauber. I'm the founder of Eldarion. I do a lot of open source stuff in Python as well, both in the Django world with things like PinX, but also a lot of other crazy things in Python over the years.
Chad Whitaker, I am leaving my comfortable corporate day job on Tuesday in a couple days to follow my heart and try and get GitTip off the ground, which is about funding open source and other free culture.
Awesome. I've been following the GitTip stuff for the past couple weeks. It seems like it's pretty exciting.
Dude, it's eating up, man.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously enough for me to take a plunge.
Sure.
Yeah.
All right. So how did you guys say, well, let's see. I know a couple of you guys have traveled quite a ways to be here. You're kind of from Virginia.
Yes.
You had a wonderful drive, I saw.
Wonderful. Absolutely fantastic. It was supposed to take 6 hours, and it took 10.
Was that in Ohio where you ran into that?
Yes.
Yeah, we got two seasons, winter and construction.
Yeah, it was one lane the whole way, and I guess there was a wreck or something.
Right. You're coming in from Boston?
I came in from Boston, as you can probably tell from my accent. I'm from the Boston area. No, not really. I did come from Boston though. Yes, my wife and I drove out here over 2 days. It was a 13-day drive that we split over 2 days.
Where'd you stop on the way?
We stayed in Allentown, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I was going to say, because I'm from Pittsburgh, and so that's about halfway, not too far.
Yeah. We were going to try to make it to Harrisburg, but didn't quite make it.
Okay. Well, I got some of the construction, too, but it wasn't quite as bad as later in the night. It was trucks that got me.
I've never seen so many trucks on the road.
Yeah, it was ridiculous.
As the I-80. Drive.
It was almost all trucks and then me.
Yeah.
Welcome to Ohio.
Well, eventually we'll have the self-driving cars, right? Pretty soon, and then
that would work quite well for this
hang out
for this sort of thing. Yeah,
whip out the laptop.
Yeah.
What are you guys working on that now? Self-driving cars?
We're not. No,
not personally.
We need to have some Google guys here.
Self-driving cars for
humans. There you go.
Yes,
you should get next show, for humans. Next podcast. You should get. Some Googlers in to talk about self-driving cars. There's got to be Python involved in that.
There has to be.
Yeah.
So why Pi Ohio this year?
I've always heard fantastic things about Pi Ohio. It's sort of been this thing that everyone talks about. It's, oh, wow, Pi Ohio was so good. That I thought, you know, I don't want to miss out on this. So, yeah, submitted a talk.
It's sort of a little bump. It's like it's the same cultural feel as PyCon. You know what I mean? It's like a community conference.
Right.
It's volunteer run.
Kind of get your fix a little bit.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Get your fix midway through the year. Kind of keep you going.
Yeah.
Bump.
All right. What brought you guys to Python? What was your inroad to Python?
My initial introduction to it was actually for a CS 112 course. It was actually my first time I used it was when I was like a kid. I was installing some obscure version of Linux, and it said, you know, bootstrapping Python in the install. That's the first time I heard about it. But, you know, I took the class, and it was terrible. Passed. But I stuck with it, and I learned a lot of other languages after that. And Python is definitely the one that resonated the most with me.
I first started using Python in 1998. I was doing a lot of stuff with Java, and a gentleman by the name of Paul Prescott told me I really should check out Python, and if I wanted to do stuff in both Java and Python, I should check out what was at the time called JPython. It's now Jython, of course. But it actually is that old, that it was around in 98. Mm. And it quickly became the language that I did all my recreational programming in. Java was the day job, and Python was what I always went home to work on at night and did all my open source projects on. And I continued to do Java until only a couple of years ago when I had the opportunity to switch 100% over to Python, not just the nighttime and weekend stuff, but the day job as well.
What version was Python when you started?
It was 1.5.
Wow.
Yeah, I skipped 1.4, but yeah, 1.5 is what I started on.
What did you start on, Ken?
Like 2.4, 2.5.
Yeah. Wow. 2.5
is about to come
out. You kids these days.
I was in between. I was like 2.1.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I actually started with Zope.
Nice.
And Plone. And I was telling somebody earlier, I mean, they're great communities. Actually, Plone in particular has had some of the most awesome sprints that you can imagine, right? They're like on top of mountains and chalets in the, you know, and castles and stuff in the European countryside. You know? It's like you're cut off from all civilization in the middle of winter and everybody's sledding and having a good time and whatnot, and then somehow sprinting. So they're a great great community. You know, but a lot of abstractions, so shall we say. And so finding Python as sort of a foundation that's actually solid underneath a lot of sort of marshmallow, let's say, was a joy to discover that it was actually down there.
We could talk about hosting stuff. Talk about hosting stuff? Is that
you guys
weird?
Have probably gone through a lot of the challenges.
I didn't bring my weaponry with me.
Right? I don't think we want to go into the differences between where you guys work and what you guys do, but you know,
we could just celebrate the fact we're both awesome.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
There we
most people don't have the challenges of hosting other people's apps and doing a lot of that stuff. They just, you know, they go to you guys and just say, host this for me. So what kind of challenges do you have in working with other people's apps and having, you know, 10,000 customers where they're all submitting different things? And
the best thing to do for me is to, you know, you have to ignore what people ask for and actually find out what they need, not what they want, in terms of feature sets and things that you support.
I mean, we certainly found I think the big surprise for us, because we built Gondor initially for our own use. It was what we needed to use for our own deployments and clients and so on. So it was initially code we were writing. The challenge that we first hit was discovering the amazing variety of ways that people would use Django that I'm like, I didn't even, never even occurred to me that you would lay out your directory structure that way, that you would do your settings that way. And so there was a lot of that kind of, and to Kenneth's point, there's a lot of, well, maybe we can help educate those people that maybe that's not the best way to lay out your project or the best way to do your settings.
That's the thing that really shocked me too, is like, I'll try to like roll out a new Django feature, and I'll just, people have the craziest settings. Well, you know, a lot of them just go through and they just copy paste things they find in blogs, and they don't know why they're putting things in where they are, and like, you can just never assume that anyone's settings are remotely
some
stable.
Kind of wacky cargo cult config pie.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's four though, right? I mean, it's four people. It's just like, it's like copy and paste, and it's up and running.
I believe so.
Well, you were telling stories the other day about like,
yeah,
using ManagePy run server.
Yeah.
In production.
Yeah, people run Manage.py run server in production.
Well, but that's not very scalable because you only have one thread.
It's not. But the platform allows you to actually make that possible, which is kind of crazy. Yeah. But yeah. We had a pretty popular website that launched, and we tried to reach out to them, help them fix it, you know, but they didn't, it was like through a subcontractor or something. They didn't want to touch it, you know, they just wanted it to run. So they like scaled to 50 dynos. Unmanaged Py run server.
Wow.
And it was a pretty big like launch of a DVD for a very popular movie. Like this media house was publishing. It's crazy.
Well, yeah, I have had that question a couple of times in Gondor support where people will say, well, how do I call run server? How do I get managed Py run server? Yeah.
Well, that sort of how to do it the right way, how not to do it the wrong way kind of reminds me of the Hitchhiker's Guide stuff that you've been working on. Can you tell our listeners out there in the interwebs what that's all about?
So, well, back to the hosting thing real quick.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, I'll get into that. The approach I take personally for the Python stuff that I own at Heroku is I try to take a different approach than, say, Gondor does, both of which are perfectly fine approaches, but I try to make it so hosting a regular Python application is the same as hosting a Django application. Like, there's no difference, and they should be just treated the same.
Which is now true of Gondor,
yes,
since we've launched the generic whiskeys.
A lot of platform providers go through this, they make it very specific to them.
Yep.
And we always try to make it so, and you guys, the new release is fantastic. A lot of platforms have very specific configurations that you have to do, you know, to work with their platform, and they'll run things for you magically. And I try to do the explicit over implicit thing.
Yep.
Yeah. So, but to Python Guide, it kind of goes into that where it's like, you know, there are these best practices that, I guess I should explain what it is, right?
Yeah, that'd be cool.
So Python Guide is a project I started that is essentially, it's a Sphinx website documentation, and it allows you to go through and read and learn about the best practices in the community for different things you'd want to do. Like if you're going to be doing a web application, it'll say to use Flask or Django. It's a little opinionated. And if you're deploying a Django application, eventually it'll have like step-by-step recommendations on what the best practice is. And that's something that as a hosting provider, that's what we both have to do.
Yep.
Is, you know, if we just made some magical switch and like the platform just kind of made everything work, which you could do, and like a lot of Ruby people would prefer that. It's not necessarily, it doesn't help anything. It'll make your application run, but it won't necessarily educate anybody. And it won't help them improve their code. And it's almost a form of vendor lock-in. So if you take the other approach of, you know, having great documentation that shows people what to do and they can do it themselves properly, it's a much better approach.
I found it kind of nice that there's something out there that has opinions and has reasonable evidence for those opinions, so that, you know, this kind of eliminates to some degree the more than one way to do it.
Yeah.
You know, that you can get easily lost in the myriad of choices. I think one of the things that I've been thinking about the Python community for a while is since we have in the Zen of Python that there should be one and preferably only one way to do it.
Yeah.
That then there's sort of an explosion of other things where, you know, like the explosion of web frameworks. Well, like, if in the language there should be only one way to do it, well, I'm going to do it, you know, I'm going to do this other thing instead. And it's not part of the core. It's not part of the thing. So
just to play devil's advocate a little bit, I think there's value to, I mean, you got to like throw a lot of options on the table, right?
Yeah.
I feel like there's, it's kind of just, you know, how open source proceeds. It's a process where you've got a lot of, like any industry, there's innovation, then there's consolidation. You know what I mean? Just like, let's throw a lot of stuff out there.
Right. And then
the time comes where it coalesces, right?
Yeah.
Like I have this one little open source project. It's called Gheat, and it puts heat map tiles over Google Maps, right? And I did it a few years ago, and I just sort of wrote it, put it out there, and didn't end up using it too much myself. But then people came along and picked it up, and I start getting all these people coming and be like, hey, I ported this to Django, and I ported this to Apache CGI, and I ported this to PHP, and I ported this to .NET, and like all of these different Python frameworks, but then other ones too. And I've sort of always had that in mind that it's like, yeah, that's cool. I don't want to gate somebody and say like, no, you can't, you know, you can't go and do that because it has to fit in the official, you know, the official way.
Mm-hmm.
Like I think there's value to that innovation, but then right at some point you want to come back around and say, all right, now let's converge and let's take the best of all of these and bring it back together.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons I'm doing the Python guide site is because, like, you know, python.org, I don't think it's necessarily a place where they should be making opinions about tools.
Right.
Maybe it should be, but at the moment it's not. So I think that's where it kind of fits in, is to complement it.
Yeah. Well, I think if the official python.org was making those kinds of opinions or decisions that feel somewhat exclusive and off-putting, maybe,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
What if I wrote something and...
Yeah, it gets political. Really,
yeah,
quick,
and
yeah,
and the consensus is not around my tool. Why should I even bother writing a tool?
And I can take that liability, but
yeah,
the PSF can't.
Right.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
Exactly the same thing happened with Pinax, where, you know, Django wasn't going to go and endorse
right
a particular app for one thing.
Right.
But we could.
Yes, you could.
Yeah. Yeah, and you can include a library that you think is best inside
right
of Pinax.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so speaking of Pinax, what's the backstory there?
Yeah.
Where did that come from and how has it grown?
Yeah, so you know, back to the days when I was doing Python in my spare time rather than my day job, I was building a lot of little websites in Django from, you know, 2006 onwards. And I noticed all these recurring patterns in all these sites I wanted to build. I was building the same things over and over again. You know, Django does a great job of sort of the lower level stuff around templating and the ORM and routing URLs and so on. But there was a lot of user facing functionality that was the same from one site to the next. And so I started building various libraries that I imagined might be usable for a whole range of sites that I wanted to do. Others became interested in these and that's what formed the Pinax project. The Pinax project has it's interesting because there's a lot of things that I think the Pinax project has achieved beyond just people using Pinax. We were the first, I think, major Python project to be on GitHub.
Mm.
We were the first major project to really take advantage of pip and virtualenv. And, you know, it was really bleeding edge stuff. There was a lot of
right
problems early on as we were doing it, but, you know, we got a lot of that sorted out. So hopefully people benefit from sort of what we've gone through, even if they aren't directly using Pinax. In terms of sort of where it's gone, there was a lot of misunderstanding that came about because when we started the project, we realized that people aren't that excited about working on reusable apps. What excites people is building sites. And so you really needed to get people interested in helping build a site. If it meant that they were building reusable apps to do that, then that was great. And it just so happened that the sort of site that we used to drive a lot of the initial development was a social network. And so a lot of people, Pinax got typecast, if you like, as a social networking platform, which it's not at all. It was always designed to just be this generic set of tools and best practices and for getting sites up more quickly. So we fought a lot of that sort of typecasting. Another thing that sort of happened as adoption of pip and virtualenv took off and use of GitHub and so on, we've become a lot more modular. So Pinax now really isn't a single project. It's not a single thing you can download. It's more of an ecosystem that includes apps. It includes what we call starter projects, which are sort of just the starting point of a bunch of apps integrated already in a particular way. The ecosystem also includes what we call themes, which are really just sort of the templates that you need for a particular collection of apps, along with some styling. When Twitter Bootstrap came along as a sort of a CSS framework, that really, in a lot of ways, Pinax is to...
server-side.
It's to server-side what Bootstrap is to... Twitter Bootstrap is for the client. And we adopted Twitter Bootstrap, which has been really great for... because people understand how to customize that. So, it's really sort of starter projects, apps, and themes. And a lot of the activity recently has been around apps. And so if you try to look for, like, how's Pinax going, you won't necessarily... There isn't a one thing you can look... There's no one repo you can look at and say, oh, they haven't checked in anything for a while. It's actually this whole ecosystem. But yeah, things are going well. We use it as the basis of every site we build at Eldarion and every site we build for clients and a lot of other people that continue to use it.
I see Habitualist is live to the world now, which is exciting.
Well, it's not. It's still closed beta. It's out there.
So, what habits are you working on?
I was just going to say there's a funny little background there that you tell the story of how you first came to hear about it.
Once upon a time at PyCon many years ago, I had gotten obsessed with this idea of sort of personal unit testing. I'd read somebody's blog about
personal
it.
Personal unit testing.
Yeah, like unit test for your life, right? Like,
do you test first? I mean, do you write your test first?
Yeah, so I would write what the tests were. And they were simple things like, I cooked dinner at least once in the last 7 days. X amount of time with my kid in the last two days, whatever. Taken a midnight feeding shift or late night feeding shift for my daughter. She was... this is when my daughter was brand new to the world. Yeah. And, those kinds of things. Sort of what would my ideal life kind of be like for the sort of mundane day-to-day things? Like, how could I feel like a better, more awesome person if all of these things were green? Mm-hmm. And I built out a whole crazy thing in Google Docs spreadsheet. And it was, so I could have graphs and things. And that was great and fun. But just the act of checking into that was a pain because it was like I had to remember to go to Google Docs. I had to remember to go and do all those things and run my tests. And just like anything, your test suite is great, but you've got to run it, right?
You've got to
have that.
You need CI.
Exactly. Where's CI for your life? Decided, I should buy a domain name and I'll build a thing. And at that point, I was pretty much living in Google Reader. And I wanted something that would harass me in my RSS feed every day, and I could just hit V and just quickly pop open the site and run through all my tests and yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, whatever, and feel good about myself. And then that's great. That went on my pile of hobbies that I never get to, and it's just sort of out there. I do own the domain name for it, but it hasn't really gone anywhere. So fast forward a few months to PyCon. I think it must have been 2008. Had you mentioned Habitualist in a talk or something? I think I'd done a blog post about it.
So this is back in my,
Because I was living in Google Reader, so I would have seen it on the Planet. I read all the Planet articles, religiously then.
When it was easy to actually keep up with them.
Yeah, exactly. And so this whole, Habitualist, that sounds really cool. If somebody makes this thing for me, then I don't have to
do it.
Build it myself. So I ran into James at PyCon and got talking with him about it and some ideas. And I think at that point, development had kind of stalled out a little, right? Because you were abstracting things out.
Yeah, I mean, what happened with Pinax is I had all these ideas for websites I wanted to build, and then I stepped back and worked on the framework, and a couple of years went past, and I realized I'd spent all my time on the framework and not building sites. So, once I started Eldarion, which was really the goal of Eldarion, first and foremost, was to go and implement all these ideas that I had had over the years. We didn't do it first, but we finally got around at the start of this year to going back to revisiting Habitualist. Mm-hmm. We've just been through a 6-month long development and private beta, and we're hoping to launch in the next couple of weeks, actually.
Awesome. Okay, so back to my question. So give me an example. Like, what are you using it for, personally?
personally. So everything from so one thing is the kind of I've got something for.
Do you have like a launch habitualist?
Well, so it's got to be right? recurring tasks. Yeah, okay, so you know, it might be. So I've got something to contribute to an open source project every day.
Okay, Julython.
Exactly. Extended to, and one of the things Habitualist we just added last week to Habitualist.
So then, what's the user interface for me? So if I'm using Habitualist and I'm using it to track my contributions to open source project, yep. That's a habit I want to do.
Right.
So it's a web app.
Yep,
right.
It's a web app. So you may have other, so just to sort of explain, you may have other more or have things that are less frequent.
Okay.
One of the other things I use it for is it's not just that I want to do this every day or three times a week. I also use it for remember to change the water filter on my, on my faucet every 10 to 12 weeks.
Okay.
It's the kind of thing that you don't want to. It's a recurring task, so you don't want it on your to-do list. But it's not something that has to be done at exactly a particular day. So you don't. A calendar doesn't necessarily make sense either.
Okay.
So the way that it works is you put all these things in. Yeah. You can have very fuzzy rules, like I want to do it every 2 to 4 weeks.
Okay.
And then what it does is presents you with the things that you could, should, or must be doing
this week,
in priority order.
Yeah.
Today, this week.
Yeah.
And
email them to you, or
So you can also set up reminders.
Yeah.
At the moment, you can be emailed. You can also receive a Twitter DM, which is actually great because that means depending on how you've set up your Twitter notifications, that can equate to a text message and everything.
Yeah.
So we're hoping to add more back ends, but you can get the reminders.
But do you find that you use it? I mean,
yeah.
How long has it been that you've been using?
Well, it obviously becomes one of the habits that you have to build.
Yeah, okay.
And you know that's very much the case. It's interesting when we added much more customizable reminders.
Okay.
Where you could be nagged 5 times a day. Remember to do your push-ups today.
Yeah.
What I found interesting was that the people that were already best at using the site turned that off.
Yeah. Right.
They didn't need it they'd already built the habit of visiting the site every day. And there are people that are obsessed with it. They have like 50 different things that they're tracking.
Really?
And they absolutely love it. And they don't need the reminders.
So weeks, months, how long has it been going that you've actually been using it? It's been usable?
6 months.
Okay.
Yeah.
See, because I've tried some habit building kind of stuff, like Mike was talking about too. And I've found that the simpler it is, the easier. You know, like if I try and do too much, I just...
So there's a couple of things there, and we're hoping to build in some of this heuristics into the site as well. The building of a habit is sort of independent of whether you're really doing the thing you ultimately need to do. So there's a lot of research that basically says, you know, if you're trying to build the habit of flossing your teeth every day, just floss one tooth.
Okay.
Right? You make it as simple as possible. You want the barrier to entry...
So low. Right.
Then you build the habit with the really, really dead simple thing, and then once you've built the habit, you can arc it up.
See, it's the complexity, the overhead that I'm trying to zoom in on. You know, it's like if I have to, you know, like Mike was saying, it's like if it's not right there,
I have a shockingly hard time actually going to Habitualist to mark stuff.
Yep.
Which I don't understand why that is. I don't understand why that barrier is
there.
Well,
maybe that's something we need to improve. I don't know.
Yeah,
you can't do magic.
Yeah, I know.
Right.
But no, there is a really big thing about, you know, BJ Fogg, a researcher at Stanford who researches exactly this whole topic of habit building.
Okay.
You know, he has this thing that what he calls tiny habits of, you know, pick three, no more than three at a time, and make them dead simple. If your goal is to do, you know, a bunch of push-ups, just do one push-up a day.
Yeah.
That's it. Just one push-up a day.
Yeah.
Build the habit with that as easy and as painless as possible.
Record that somewhere, that's like if that's so simple, doing one push-up, if the cost of recording the doing the one push-up isn't minimal, you know, then it's...
Sounds like a personal problem.
Maybe, I don't know.
So I have.
I never doing a timesheet.
I try to track, you know, I work from home, so like it's really easy for me to just never do much, essentially.
Right.
So I try to like make sure my calories are, I'm actually like being a little active at least. So I got this fuel band thing, which is pretty awesome.
Fuel band.
I actually got one as well, and I forgot to bring the cord to charge it, so it ran out of batteries yesterday.
You can plug it right into your laptop.
Does it actually go,
yeah.
I don't need the cord?
Yeah,
okay.
That's optional.
Perfect.
Okay. Yeah.
So how are you fun? Tell us about it.
So essentially, you know, it's around my wrist, and it essentially just reminds me that, you know, I have set a goal, and then it tells me where I'm at the goal. So I'm like, 3/4 of the way there today because I've been walking around a bit.
There are blinking lights. It's really exciting.
I'm sorry, so this is a pedometer? Or?
It's essentially a pedometer, but it's an accelerometer. It knows my weight and my height, and it like can determine how many calories I've used.
I found that it's quantifying exactly how lazy I am.
Is that what you want?
Well, the scary thing is, so they sort of when you set it up, you set a goal, as Kenneth said, and they kind of recommended things as if you're not very active, you have a goal of 2,000.
Yeah, that's
active,
what I'm using right now.
If you're active, it's 3,000, and if you're really really active, it's 5,000. So I'm like, I'm not very active. I'm going to do 2,000. First day I used it, I didn't even get to 1,000. I'm like, I knew I was sedentary, but not that bad. So it's been great though, because once you hit the two, I noticed that if I walk somewhere,
and if it's like so close to the edge and you're not there, you'll go out of your way.
I'm gonna take the stairs. Yeah. I'm gonna go for an extra walk around the block, or whatever.
And then just seeing it on your wrist just reminds you constantly, like, maybe I shouldn't take the elevator.
So that actually ties back to both what Chad and Mike were saying in terms of the cost of going and checking it off.
Right.
We want to integrate as much as possible with things. So the only thing we support at the moment is GitHub. If you check into GitHub, you can hook up a repository. So if you've got a habit that you're trying to build, like work on GitTip at least three times a week, you can hook it up so that it knows you've checked in. Okay. But I'd love to do something that ties in with this. I want to do things. A lot of people have goals like I want to tweet once a day, or I want to write a blog post once a week.
Right.
Those sort of things can be tested automatically.
Do you know about if this, then that?
That's true.
Yes, I do, and I would love them
to
add us as a channel.
That would be fantastic.
Anybody have a contact out there?
The guy knows me. I don't know. We never met, but
we're use online that. If people. He knows you, then leverage that.
Somebody out there.
I'll send him a message.
Someone out there in podcast land.
If they're a big guy. If this, then that. Then if you use if this, then that, then contact us.
Yes, you just mentioned GitTip. Can you tell us a little bit about GitTip?
Oh, man, I can tell you a lot about GitTip. So GitTip is, the tagline right now is personal funding. So the idea is it's Kickstarter for people. Kickstarter tells you explicitly that you can't set up a Kickstarter just to fund my life. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, imagine some like lazy college kid who's like, dude, just give me like, 20 grand and I'll be set, So GitTip is that. GitTip is for ones just like, just give me like 20 grand and I'll be set. So, right. Not tied to a project. It's tied to a person, exactly. So the idea is, people who are building open source software, we're starting with this, right? But we want to broaden it to anybody who's giving back, right? Building free culture. So the MacArthur Foundation, Genius Grants, this is one sort of entree into it. Genius Grants, every year the MacArthur Foundation picks 30 people and they call them up and they say, congratulations, we're giving you $500,000 for free, right? The idea is no strings attached. Mm-hmm. You're a genius. We want you to just keep being a genius, okay? So, like, if we tried to come up with something for you to do, it would be stupider than whatever you would come up with because you're smarter than us. You're the genius.
And they give it to anyone from scientists to artists.
Exactly,
to humanitarians, whoever, whatever it is.
Yeah, yes.
Anyone who's doing amazing stuff.
And they're not, they don't even know they're in the running until they get the phone call, right? So that's cool. So GitTip is genius grants for the rest of us, right? It's like pretty smart grants. it's crowdsourced, right? So the idea is, if 1,000 people, believe in what James Tauber is doing and want him to just like keep doing more of it, I've been watching him over the years, right? Like, just he's always coming out with new projects. I'm like, man, another one? Like, how do you keep up with that? The same way. I mean, like, he's got a few years on you, but it's like, man, you guys are so prolific. It's like hard to keep up with you guys. But yeah, so it's like imagine if you didn't have to pay the bills. You know what I mean? Like, that would be scary. You're just like, look, just keep do all the stuff. You were talking in your talk earlier, Kenneth, about just like wanting to open source everything. It's like, all right, well, let's just set these people free to just open source everything and just like open source all the things. So that's what GitTip is about, right? Like, if you come up with 1,000 people, they're gonna give you $3 a week, right? Like, imagine the value that can be added to the commons, right? It's about the commons. It's about building the commons. It's about funding the people that are building the commons, right? And
it's recurring and it's weekly.
It's recurring,
which is
let's get to the specifics, right? So you set up a small tip once a week it hits. So every Friday, we're going to pull in money from your credit card and we're going to distribute it in small amounts to the people that you're funding. And we're so many interesting things going on with it. So we're on week 8. And so this past Friday, we moved almost $1,000. It was like $950, pulling in from about 180 people and going out to about the same number of people. And I haven't looked at it exactly, but it's not, you know, the Venn diagram isn't a full overlap, right? So it's not just, you know, moving from the same 180 people to the others. But it's been growing, right? So that's $1,000 in 8 weeks, so starting from zero, so it, which is about where I wanted to be. I was looking at doubling every week, and I think I you know, doing that, I had it myself at $1,200 a week for Pi Ohio. I'm going out to the XOXO Festival in Portland in September, and if we keep doubling every week until then, I think we're going to be at like a few $100,000 a week. So I really, like, I'm leaving my job on Tuesday. I'm pouring myself into this. I really want to see this take off. I have no idea where it's going to go, but it's really fun.
You know? And GitTip doesn't take any percentage for itself.
Because I'm trying to drink my own Kool-Aid, right? I'm trying to find my own living on GitTip rather than running it as a traditional business where I'm taking a 10% cut like Kickstarter does, or I'm taking a 10% cut like Flatter does. You know, I'm saying I'm going to price it to cost. So I'm charging you as little as I can. And I'm just throwing it out there and saying, look, if you believe in GitTip, if you like what I'm doing, then go ahead and support me on it as well, right? Right, so I'm trying to, yes.
Which is currently working because you're the number one.
Well, it's currently working in that I'm number one. It's not currently working in that I'm able to pay my mortgage. So, yeah, we'll see. So, I mean, this is a whole other interesting side thing, but I've got this, yeah, well, right. Like I said, I could talk for a long time.
Right, GitTip, right. But check it out. And we were talking about Aspen.
Aspen, yeah, so Aspen is my,
Aspen.
Dude, Aspen is the love of my life. I have this web framework. I started it in 2006, way before Heroku named the Aspen stack. You know,
oh, that's right.
Way before Heroku was a bean in, you know, somebody's eye. Yeah, so Aspen is a web framework. Here's the thing. MVC was designed in 1979 or whatever at Xerox PARC, right, to build desktop GUI applications, right? And it's genius for organizing your code to build desktop GUI applications. It's a total kludge to use it for server-side web programming. You know, like, whose idea was that, to use this MVC pattern for server-side web programming? You know, I actually found the guy whose idea it was, and I tried to tweet to him, and he didn't respond to me. So I don't know exactly what he was thinking, you know, but I think it came out of, it was in the Java world, and I think, you know, it came out of Sun in the late 90s. But so the MVC pattern, I think, is a real mismatch for server-side web programming. The object-oriented model that, you know, that I learned in the Zope days, I don't think is the right pattern for server-side web programming. You've got an URL in the address bar, and you've got a file on the file system. They're both paths, right? So, like, why do we have this big black box of regular expressions and URL, you know, and traversal of objects, you know, to get from a path to a path? So Aspen has two principles. All of your URLs map directly to files on the file system, and the second principle is that when you get to that file on the file system, they're broken into pages using the ASCII page break character, which is the interesting twist on it, and you know, you either love it or hate it.
Or the alternative, caret L.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
I think you should just go for the pure ASCII character. I was saying this to Kenneth before. There's these great control characters in ASCII.
There are.
Yeah.
That have really useful semantic meaning. Yeah, we should use them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Emacs does. You know, if you use caret L, if you use page break in Emacs, you can actually navigate. There's, you know, bindings to navigate by pages in your file. So Aspen breaks your file, so you go URL down to file in the file system. Your file is broken into pages. So that's the basic principle. And then, see, there's this whole pattern of web development from simple to complex. It sort of comes out in the wash when you have those principles. So throwing a static file on the web is really simple. You just put a stupid file there and serve it, right? And it sort of moves up in gradations of complexity all the way up to WebSockets. I mean, there's a WebSocket server-side implementation buried inside of Aspen, right? And it works on the same principles of, you know, mapping files, URLs to files, and using pages within that file.
Okay. So to me, this kind of resembles the PHP mindset.
Exactly. Like, that's, you know, it's heresy to say in a Python podcast, but that's nice about PHP. You know, it's like, it's simple. It's like a .php, and I open up my .php file.
You move your folders over, and that's your sub.
Yeah, exactly. You just move stuff around. I mean, and it's really not limited to Python. I mean, I ported Aspen to Ruby on Wednesday, you know, during this joint...
it took you how long to learn Ruby and do it?
Well, I had a lot of help, but it was about an hour that over beers. There was some 120-minute IPA that we did. It was a joint, I'm from Pittsburgh, and it was a joint, it's good. It's actually illegal in Ohio, from what I understand. But, in Pennsylvania, we're a little loose when we do that, but actually, that's not true. So Aspen.io is the website.
Cool.
You know, it's kind of a fool's errand to try and start a web framework in this day and age with all the heavyweights around. But
that hasn't stopped it.
Call me a fool, you
so
know?
Far,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, right.
If everyone took that attitude, we wouldn't have the web frameworks
right.
that we all use.
Yeah. was anybody at PyCon in D.C. when Michelle Levesque gave her talk? Dave, I think you were there.
I was there.
About... The myriad choices that...
That was with Brian, right?
Yeah, Brian the stick figure, and he's an intern in college, and he has to figure out how to put up a website in Python, and so what are his choices? And there was all, you know, Cherry Pie, and...
Webware, and all
those
all
the battle days, and there was a plea to please, you know, let's have a web framework that's awesome and really good. And then from there, well...
Just blew up even more.
Yeah. Now there are more web frameworks, so... I don't think Brian's job has gotten any easier.
But that's different. Another case where you saw lots of proliferation.
Yeah.
And then you saw convergence, you know, around Django in that round.
Yep.
And we'll see what's next.
Well, speaking of things that are converging, it seems like there's a lot of convergence around requests right now.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Which I'm very thankful for.
We're using it.
Cool.
I'm awesome. So happy that we're using it because it saved my butt a couple times. I was writing automated tests for a file upload API.
Yeah.
And I'm like, man, I really don't want to learn how to do that in raw HTTP lib nonsense land. And like, hey, Kenneth, does request do this? And you're like, yes, it does. How easy. Files equals blah. Done. Thank you. I think the only problem that I've encountered so far is how do you release so much so fast? Like, by the time we've got a new package installed out to production for all of our fun things we have to deal with. There's at least like 3 or 4 releases since then.
Yeah, well, that's the big thing that keeps me away from the standard library and trying to get it in there is because standard library is where a project goes to die essentially.
Yeah. Right.
It needs to be stable.
No, I don't.
It
like
needs
that
to be completely
because it's maturity. You know.
Yes. Yeah. It needs to be stable.
Yeah,
which means it's dead.
That's the positive spin on it. It's got to have achieved a stability, which means it can't have changed. And you know, because it's not. You're stuck with what you put in the standard library. You're stuck with
forever
for at least a couple of years.
But you know what, man? There's something good about that because then you've got a standard library with batteries, right?
Absolutely. Until it's stable, it doesn't belong there though. And there, I can put it in and have it available outside and have, but that just causes so much confusion.
See, I went through. I'm on my third payment processor for GitTip. That's in 8 weeks.
Yeah.
Okay. And so the first one I had was this startup that like disappeared on me. Right, and like took all my credit card data with me, you know, and it's like, and I had to get at the, you know, to the
compliant.
I had to get to the top of Hacker News before I could get a callback from them, you know, from support for these guys, you know, and they're like, take down your blog post. But my point is, you know, something that came out on that Hacker News thread is like, look, you've got these old school companies that have been doing, you know, these old school merchant accounts, right? There's all these new Stripe and Braintree and all these new startups doing merchant accounts and simplifying the whole thing, which is awesome. But it's like the old company, it's like, yeah, they sucked, but like you could count on them to suck consistently for years. It's like as long as you like work, you write the wrapper that you were talking about, it's like you abstract that, and then you can just leave.
Yeah.
You know?
So you're welcome to use your lib too.
Yeah.
I'm glad that you wrote the wrapper. My point is, I don't know, yes. It's not... Yes, they go there.
There's
to
definitely value
to
having batteries, but it's also, it's a double-edged sword. Like Django... It's all batteries, but the bad part of that is everyone uses all the batteries, and if you want to replace one part, sometimes it can be difficult. So there's value to bringing your own batteries as well. So BYOB for modules.
So we can compromise and call it URLib3 and put it in this.
Well, isn't there an URLib3 underneath it or something?
Yeah, they're actually already, that's taken. So
four.
3,000.
Yeah. Quit messing around.
Well, so when I actually went to make requests, it started up, I was working on like a wrapper for the Convoy API, and I started with the shim that everyone does, you know.
Rest its soul.
Yeah. Let's have a moment of silence. Okay.
I like saying it Convore.
So I wrote the shim that I was using for it, and then I just started like, oh, I'm gonna make this a separate module, and then I started making it fit every use case as I was learning them, and that became requests. And it was a wrapper around Urlib too, and that turned out to be extremely difficult to maintain. Mm. So the irony of the whole thing is I hate Urlib too, and you know, so I had to become intimately familiar with it.
Yeah.
I had to know how to do everything with it to support it. So I eventually wanted to go back to HTTP Live and do that part myself, and I did. And then I wanted to do connection pooling too. And then there's this awesome library with a terrible name called Urlib3, which is actually, I didn't know at the time, it's a joke, because you know, Urlib 1 and 2 really have nothing to do with each other. So 3 doesn't have to do with any of the other two either. So I met up with him. His name is, he goes by Shaza online. Shadow with a W or with a Z, sorry. Audrey Petrov. And it does connection pooling. And it has like a little wrapper around HTTP Lab. So it's using that now, and it's really awesome. Yeah. And then I had a meeting with Armin Roniker, the Flask guy, at PyCon, and we're going to try to, it's a lot of work, but the plan is to do, essentially, like, so when you're using Flask underneath, you're using this library called WorkZug, that is like all these WSGI utilities. And, you know, so when you say send a request from requests, you build it, you know, and then it goes to a Flask app, and, you know, he's parsing all the headers and the cookies and stuff like that, and it's doing stuff and returning it, and then I'm going to take the response and parse it and do all this other, we're replicating all this work. So we're going to take all the common components, put them into its own library, and then share the same code base, and
so
it'll be pretty awesome.
Can I, if I have a requests request object, can I get back to the bytes, the raw HTTP message?
Yeah.
What's the API for that?
Response.raw.
Response.raw.
Yeah.
Response.raw for response?
Well, the response is the object, yeah.
Okay.
So just the raw attribute. And that's the actual socket object.
Which, yeah.
That's returned, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
My first time at PyOhio, actually, so it's my new favorite conference, I guess.
Might as well.
Were things in James's keynote?
Oh my gosh, yeah.
speaking of all these projects. Yeah, speaking of all these projects and being so prolific, like all these mind-blowing weird things that he brought to us first thing in the morning, bright and early. Like, so the good news is we've got the explicit tag, so we can talk about brain fuck all we want. But like, there is just something about having to see an implementation of brain fuck first thing in the morning at the beginning of the conference. It's just a wonderful tone for the next 2 days.
Did you actually write an interpreter for it? I missed your talk.
He did.
Yes.
Okay.
But look, it's the interpreter didn't seem like it was that. I mean, there's only 8 commands, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So that, you know,
the interpreter
really
with the exception of the brackets, it's effectively one line.
I mean, for each
instruction code.
So
writing
the interpreter for BrainFuck's not the hard part. It's debugging. You know, it's debugging the
program.
It's like
testing the
output of the program. Like you have to read the BrainFuck. That's the point. That's the hard part.
Exactly.
Not the Python side.
Exactly.
So
yeah, the Python side was trivial.
Yeah.
The have you guys seen Whitespace? Speaking
yes.
of
no,
esoteric
haven't.
Languages, it's essentially brain fog. Oh, yeah, you're hilarious.
Right.
Yes.
It's
brain
fog, exactly.
But you use spaces and tabs instead of, you know, random.
So,
characters.
James, have you written programs in Whitespace?
Not in Whitespace, no.
Okay.
No. But I could probably modify my brain fog implementation to support.
That'd be cool if there was like an esoteric.
Implementation and use that to take a Python ask. And convert a Python program.
Yes.
To
that would be a real challenge.
Write an LLVM compiler.
I was thinking about an LLVM.
So you could take Java, like, you know, a brainfuck app. Oh, a Python app, convert it to brainfuck, and then from there go to JavaScript with the, what's it called? I can't remember the name of it. There's the thing that converts JavaScript.
Right.
LLVM to JavaScript.
Right. Okay.
Inscripting, that's it.
Yes,
it's a short distance from that to brainfuck and brainfuck, right? Is that at the inception moment?
Brainfuck.
So you have, so like Popeye.
Fuck.
Yeah.
E-fuck.
Yeah.
That's better than brain. I think my point is that, like, in order to do that, like, you actually had to write brainfuck programs. You know, like everybody, like I go look at Brainfuck and I'm like, oh my gosh, Brainfuck.
Right.
But I, like, I've never actually, like, I don't take that next step of insanity.
I've actually tried to write something.
Write a Brainfuck program.
Right.
And you have.
Well, not a little bit, yeah.
I mean, Hello World or something.
Yeah, I was so very grateful that your slide was Hello World. Like, well, it's like, nobody else is saying anything. It's worth a shot. I guess that's a safe guess.
I
mean,
I only asked that question because I figured somebody would guess that it was Hello World.
That Ultima 4 map was also a glorious thing to
see. Have you seen the actual, the full size version?
No, I don't think I've seen the full size version.
Okay, I'll have to show you sometime. So basically, the way that Ultima 4 was the first game I really, really got into, and even back on the Apple II where I played it, I was hacking on the file formats and everything, and when I went back to it, I thought, you know, I would love to do a full size map using the individual tiles. So I found the file that had the tiles, and they're each 16 by 16, I think. And then I found the world map that simply said for each spot on the map which tile to use.
Mm-hmm.
And then I already had code I'd written for generating PNGs. So it's this 4096 by 4096 map. If you open it up in an image viewer and you magnify it four times the real size, so 400%, it actually looks like it did
while you're playing
on the
game.
Original. Yeah. Oh, you can navigate around, yeah.
It sounds like those Minecraft world viewers that people
write.
Yeah. Right?
Yep.
That's awesome. I think the one you talked about that was most impressive to me was the Cherny, when you were talking about the BOE files.
Yep.
And reverse engineering the format, the file format for, you know, to describe it for people listening. What do you say? This is the raw data that's coming out of this high-end piano
for people playing
the Goldberg variations.
Right? Bösendorfer makes a piano that outputs... it's a lower level
than
MIDI. I didn't know at first that this is what the file had. All I knew was that these files coming out of a Bösendorfer somehow described how the piece was being performed.
Like OSC or something?
And no, I mean, it's a proprietary format.
Okay.
But the Open Goldberg project sent me the raw files from the performance of the Goldberg variations. And yeah, reverse engineered the...
Well, okay, so now here's my question.
Uh-huh.
So how hard did you try to contact somebody within Bösendorfer to get the spec for that?
I looked
Before
around
you
for the spec. It's more fun.
Yeah, exactly.
Literally no fun. Well,
it's the same
thing. I've also done the same thing for Lord of the Rings. I'm a big player of Lord of the Rings Online, on and off. I sometimes go months without playing, but it's really the only game I've played for.
You
last
know, there's
years.
This habit tracking website that I've heard of.
And the same thing with that. I've poured hours and hours into
reverse
engineering the file format there, and. I mean, yeah, somebody who works at Turbine could just probably tell me.
Right.
But it's a lot more fun looking at hex dumps and trying to work out what it all means.
Are you familiar with Steel?
Yes. Yeah. You mean Marty's?
Yeah, he had a. Yeah. The older name was like Bokadine
or
something.
He and I have talked a bit about that.
It's essentially this module that for Python 3 that allows you to... It's like a declarative format for binary data structure.
Yeah, it sort of looks a bit like the Django models.
Huh. But you
basically say this file consists of, a double word followed by, three bytes.
How does it
relate
to the struct module?
It just is a lot more powerful.
Yeah.
Think of it almost
entire
as...
Like you can do PNG
exactly
at a couple lines, I think.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's like the difference between
a regular
expression and a full recursive transition network kind of thing. Like it's, you know, with struct, you've got... You can't do repeatability whereas Steel lets you say this is a section that repeats
STEEL,
times.
STEEL?
Yeah.
Cool.
It's pretty awesome. It's way over my head.
What did you use it for?
I just know about it, and it fascinates me because I'd love to get into that stuff, but I have no use case.
The reason I haven't used that for this stuff is that 99.9% of the time I'm trying to work out how the file works. So a lot of the stuff I do is jump into a particular offset and try running it through zlib to see if it's compressed. that kind of stuff. So once I've worked it out, then Steel would be a great way of representing
serializing.
By then, you've moved on to the next project. It's boring once you've
right, exactly. I'll let someone else actually make it practical and useful.
I'm trying to remember the name of this project, but it was done by like the Navy, and they open sourced it. And essentially, you just throw an image of some sort, like a disk image, and it just sucks all the files that it recognizes out of it. And you use it for like RAM.
So it's like strings like times.
For any like known data structure, it'd be cool to like write something that automatically detects those.
Yep.
Like the manual process you go through to try to like you just say I'm trying to get
the real
files.
Challenge.
Yeah.
Put yourself out of a not a job, but a yes. A
automate it.
Yes.
Automate,
automate the whole person.
You could document the process you mentally go through of doing this by hand and try to like just make
somebody's
it.
Somebody's got to be doing that somewhere.
So, if they do, they probably don't know about it. That'd be amazing though.
Yeah, your Apple II emulator also is pretty impressive. Got some good applause, I think.
That's probably the most comprehensive and complete, I guess, of the projects that I talked about. That started. It's funny the iteration of that over time. I started that in 2001. It was hosted on SourceForge, and I did a bunch of iterations. Never quite got it working. Got pretty far, but never quite got it working. In 2007, I decided to go back to the project. I put it on Google Code because that was the, it was, you know,
right.
So 2001 was all about SourceForge. In 2007, it was all about Google Code. Put it on Google Code, got a little bit further, didn't get particularly far. 2011, I thought, I'm going to go back to it. I decided I'd gone down the wrong path in 2007, so I went back to my 2001 code and put it on GitHub, because of course 2011 you put it on GitHub.
Exactly.
I tweeted I've put this up on GitHub.
Okay.
Within an hour I had pull requests with new features.
That's
so
amazing.
The project had been around for 10 years with no one else contributing. Put it on GitHub and tweet once.
Yeah.
Already getting contributed.
Well, the tools that we have now are insane. You know? Like the amount of work, I mean, you know, so GitTip, so I've been working on it for, you know, 2 months. You know, on the side, we'll have a day job, right? And it's like, you can get really far with GitHub and with Twitter.
Yep.
You know, Hacker News.
Stuff. Astronomically far.
Heroku, you know, is where this one's hosted on.
Yep. So, yeah, the Apple II was a lot of fun because it, the way I described it to somebody years ago was that it was implementing it was exercising muscles I hadn't used in years.
Right.
Because all of a sudden I had to remember my 6502.
Right.
and you just have to think about things in a completely different way when you're, when you're doing assembly language programming. Well, I wasn't even doing that. I was trying to pretend to be.
And remembering how to do basic programming.
Remembering how to do basic programming even was... I was thinking, I used to do this.
So what was your first language before
I was just about to ask that. Okay. My very first language was GW Basic. I'm a younger guy, so I got this thing. I inherited this really old machine from like a family that we knew.
Okay.
And they gave it to me because they knew I liked computers.
Yeah.
It is like in probably 2001, and it was like one of the very first IBM home computers.
Mm-hmm.
It had a 20 meg hard drive and like a couple K RAM. It was DOS 4, so GW Basic. I upgraded that to Q Basic with DOS 5, and I got Edit, which was a real big step up because I was like doing the line editor thing.
Oh yeah,
Ed. And my dad, you know, he's an engineer and he works on flight simulators, so he had all these old, really old at the time, apps on floppies that I would install. So I got to learn Turbo C++, the Borglind original IDE, and Pascal.
Yep.
I learned those in like sixth grade. But I was like just making little like adventure games and stuff.
So I had this theory. I think Pascal was the Python of its time.
I think that
seems like it.
It seems reasonable. Yeah.
When I look back at it,
it was
much cleaner.
Was
it was much more explicit.
That was my intro CS class way back when.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was Pascal. Yeah. The first language is Basic, and I
the tool chain is a lot easier to use too.
I spent a long time in HyperTalk.
Is that before HyperCard, or is that related at all?
That's HyperTalk. It's HyperCard scripting language.
Oh,
okay. HyperTalk. Yeah,
I've never met anyone.
A high school friend of mine and I implemented Star Control in HyperTalk. It's kind of crazy and not really great, but it worked, and you could fly little spaceships around and blow each other up. So that was
kind
that's
of
good.
What
kind
of what type of a language was it? Was it like an action script type of a thing? Or?
Yeah, it bears a lot of resemblance to AppleScript now.
Okay. So very like English-ish?
Yeah, there's a lot of the button, the this, the that, or this button, or that button.
What about you, Chad?
Well, I started with Basic on a PC Junior.
Mm-hmm.
So there was.
So
no,
you were the one that
drive.
Had the PC Junior.
There was no. And I can't. My mother. It's like my mother got rid of it when I went to college, and I came back from college. And was like, Mom, no. Yeah. So, but no hard drive on that. You know,
nice.
Like floppy drives and these cartridges. You had these cartridges. So I had cartridge basic.
Oh man.
That's what I learned. And with a manual, it was like a literal book. You know, that you like opened with pages and it told you what all the commands were. And I poured over that. But see, where it really got fun was in high school when we had the TI graphing calculator.
Oh, yeah.
Did you guys ever
do
that?
Yeah, programming those things.
You could put all their, you know, if there was a certain formula you needed to know for physics class,
okay.
You could just put it in there.
Oh, yeah.
And then
no one would ever do that. Right? I certainly wouldn't do that to pass all of my physics and chemistry
the
exams.
The beauty of it is that it doesn't do a syntax check when you save, so you could put anything into the program and just have plain text all the answers.
See, we didn't even, we just didn't bother, we just blew off our physics homework because we were just making games for the thing. You know? So like, we had Minesweeper on there, and we had Gorilla and stuff like that, and driving games. But then, you know, we never got, like, there were ways to get below the programming language, right? We're actually, like, working in assembler on the calculator, and I didn't take it that far. You know, James, you probably did.
I never did stuff with a programmable calculator, but...
What was your first?
Basic on a TRS-80 Model 1 that was borrowed, and then a TRS-80 color computer was
okay.
The first computer that my family bought. So that had cartridges as well.
Yeah.
And funnily enough, the second language I learned after BASIC on those was actually 6809.
Wow.
Assembly language. Because my dad bought me this a cartridge with a editor assembler.
Yeah.
On it, and so I was really spoilt that the very first assembly language I learned was probably the greatest 8-bit. Instruction set in the world, the 6809. And then I went to 6502 when I had an Apple II. And I think that ruined me because I look at x86,
yeah.
I'm like, this is
really?
Awful.
Yeah.
This is so bad.
I remember being jealous of the TRS-80 kids back in the day because there was a Superman comic, right? The Whiz Kids from Radio Shack, and Superman was promoting them. I'm like, man, Superman's not doing stuff with Apple. Why does Superman
Oh, how the tables have turned.
Yes, indeed.
But I feel like the Apple II, like I understood the Apple II as a 12-year-old way better than I understand how computers work now.
Oh, yeah.
I've got no idea now. compared, I mean, because the Apple II, the operating system, well, the ROM was 12K, the disk operating system was 3K.
Yeah.
So it was feasible that you could print out a disassembly
and
actually read every single line
on a dot matrix printer with those things on the side.
To rip
it was
off
so
from
fun
the side.
Ripping
off. That's like
but I've got no idea. I have no idea how things operating systems work now. I've even tried like looking at Linux 0.1 back when it was sort of you could fit it in your head. Don't understand it at all. Yeah.
Well, it's nice to see the love for the Apple II. Seems like it's making a little bit of a resurgence.
Yeah.
Hearing that beep noise was really nice.
Yeah,
that was what I had to do to get that beep to work.
Yeah,
made it all worthwhile. Just to hear it the first time.
The sound you hear when you're listening to the beginning of the podcast is an Apple II starting up.
Oh, really?
A beep and the disk drive whirring, and then somebody banging on the Apple II keys that I layered all together because I've missed that sound in my life. I've seen some video of something, you know, of an Apple II on YouTube, and I was like, oh my god, that's like the best sound I've heard in so long.
It took
I missed
you to
that.
Your happy place.
Yeah, it took me to the happy place. So I have this now this sort of fantasy of running like awesome Python stuff on the Apple II. Wouldn't that be the thing?
Have you guys ever played with the Silicon Graphic machines that from back in the day?
No.
It's been a long time. I've found like a refurbished one I got to play with. And when you turn them on, they all have different sounds. They're pretty awesome. They have like the big band jazz like hit. Mm. Stuff like that. It's not as cool as the old Apple sounds. But.
We had 5 Next computers.
Oh, really?
In high school. They like renovated and did all this technology stuff the year after I left. We had 5 Next computers in the basement and then like a bunch of,
were they the cubes
upstairs.
Or the pizza boxes?
They were the boxes.
The pizza boxes.
I really
the
want one of those.
We had all these OS2 machines hooked up to Laserdisc players. and they were basically good for, you could make crazy PowerPoint-like things that have videos embedded in them and pictures from the encyclopedia, and that's about it. And then no one will ever use them again. Yeah.
So I have to do a bit of a plug here, because these conversations happen whenever you get two geeks in a room, you get that question coming up. What was the first language you learned? What was the first computer you had? So I actually built a site with a couple of my colleagues a couple of years ago called MyTechne, M-Y-T-E-C-H-N-E .com, where people can actually record their memories.
Yeah. Oh, awesome. Cool.
What programming language they learned,
I'm doing that. That's so awesome.
It's been a neat trip down memory lane.
Yeah. It triggers a lot of memories.
Yeah. And it makes me happy to see when something I've searched for already exists. I don't have to plug it in. It's like, somebody else did that.
Well, see, and you always want to put it on your resume. You know, it's like you always want to start your resume with, like, I was four when I started. Like, all right, I guess I'll cut that out. Right. It's like, you need some outlet for that kind of thing.
I'm really thankful that I got the opportunity to, like, inherit all this really old stuff. Like, because everyone else is running 98, like Windows 98.
Did you have flight simulators in your basement?
Yeah, so you were saying, you were saying a 20 meg hard drive.
Yeah, Winchester drive.
So that would have, even though you got it in 2001, like 86, 87. Yeah.
And I was thinking. When I got it, everyone else was running Windows 98.
Yep.
Yeah, so it was pretty old stuff. Yeah. So when I have kids, I'm giving them an NES, and then I'm going to try to do the whole... I'm going to have a lot of social experiments when I do have kids. But I like the idea of doing, because it was actually tremendously valuable for me to have all that context that most people my age don't have. So I like the idea of giving them an NES and then an SNES and an N64. Or even just keeping them there, you know. I don't know.
I'll tell you what, you're right. I have four kids, and my 11-year-old is really good at closing a browser window when the parents walk in the room, you know? It's like, how can I yell at you for that?
And my 4-year-old already knows that if mommy and daddy don't know the answer, she will demand that you ask your phone.
Yes.
Oh, man.
She's already fallen down the Siri rabbit hole. It's so funny. So Kenneth, when the time comes to socially engineer your kids, 456123, four, then one, then five, then two, three, and then six. We're talking Star Wars movies here.
Oh, okay, yeah. Okay. Yeah. It would be...
Or omit one entirely.
Four, five, six, that's it.
Okay.
When they're adults, they can decide for themselves.
Once they're legally emancipated, they can watch whatever they want. Until they're 16 years old.
Absolutely.
While they're still under my roof.
And, you know, actually, I have that benefit, too, because I have seen all of the original Star Treks and never any other show. None of the remakes or anything like that. So, I like that.
Classic Trek holds up better than the others.
It does. Yeah, and the other ones are too, like, people get really sucked into those. The original ones are fun. Yeah.
My wife's a Next Generation
fan. I don't get that.
Yeah.
It's too much for me. Exactly.
Actually, we don't have television shows on MyTechne. We need to add...
Yeah,
there you go. Sci-fi shows.
That'd be pretty awesome.
Yeah. Techni, so people can say what they watched.
So what do you have now? You have like computers,
programming
and languages.
Text editors use, games, what consoles,
Wasn't there like what computing magazines you
read?
I had
like magazines.
Byte and that stuff.
You have video game consoles too?
Yeah.
All right.
This is a removable media one too.
Yeah.
Zip drives, jazz.
I got my first MP3 player when they were like brand new. Yeah. It said on the box, no skipping. It's 32 megabytes.
That was the...
I did
RCA. When you installed it, you had to download the driver from like the original copyright holders of the MP3 spec. The Johnson, I don't remember the name of the company anymore. Uh-huh. But there was like one player that was really licensed to play them properly. To do the real rips. What was it?
Minidisc? Was that the point?
No. This is just a little RCA thing.
Oh, okay.
But like to make proper rips, you had to there's that licensing dispute over it. So you had to get it from like this weird site.
Then Napster came out. We started calling computers Napster clients.
Well, so this is gonna sound terrible. I have an uncle that just got out of prison for 18 years.
Word.
He's a great guy now. But he went in, and I've been learning all these fascinating things talking to him.
Yeah, right.
Because when he went in,
time warp.
Yeah, exactly. Well, he had NPR to listen to on the radio there, but he went in 18 years ago. So he was asking me about he hears that Apple computers don't get viruses and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And he was asking if they're better than IBM's, And I told him about how I work on this cloud thing.
Yeah, wow.
And he was like, he's like, so you work on the mainframes, you know?
Right.
It's awesome.
That is pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
So what's the future?
right now.
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah. what's on the horizon or what's stuff that
I
you're
excited
about?
I think
self-driving
cars.
Self-driving
cars. We talked about to start.
I just, yeah. Good Lord, man. Who knows?
I wireless charging is soon.
Right.
Did you see that TED Talk that someone did? They have like this, essentially this strip they put. Right now you can mount it under a MacBook or an iMac, and it'll just like charge your devices if
okay.
they have a special chip on.
Yeah, like the induction.
Yeah, exactly.
Stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, like has some like it does like harmonics with electronic like electro harmonics or something. Huh. But you can like eventually. Apparently, the plan is like mount these things in walls, and then like your devices will charge when you're at home. I think
yeah.
that'll
and
be
you won't
10
get
years.
Cancer at all.
If I do, I'm okay with that.
So are you asking us about general prognostication or just what's in the future
yeah,
for
that's
our
a pretty
guys?
Big
yeah,
question.
What's in the future for you guys? What's coming up?
Well, I'm
what's
probably
kids,
back
kids
to Kenneth,
I think.
Yeah. They're yeah. not in the roadmap.
yeah.
Holding those up as long as possible. Well, for Heroku, I'm adding Python 3 and PyPy support soon.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. PyPy.
Yeah, well, of course. That's all I've really wanted since I started is to do that.
Then you're going to move on. You're gonna like PyPy.
Yeah, Flask is going to be obviously the go-to web framework.
Aspen,
or Aspen.
You got to make sure Aspen works on Gondo. You need to.
I do.
I'm interested in seeing what replaces Python. You know, because obviously we're not going to be doing Python forever,
right?
And you know, like I retire in like 42 years, I'm clearly not going to be working at Heroku doing Python then.
So here's a future question: Meteor. Talk about Meteor?
I think it's pretty awesome.
You know, is it going to really achieve the dream of abstracting away all of the mess that currently we all have to keep in our heads, the HTTP and, you know,
I think it's
client-side,
server-side.
What is Meteor for people who don't know?
So it's this Node.js. So the promise of Node.js when it was released was, you know, you can the big pitch,
right?
You know, for people not like us that use Gvent and don't see the purpose of Node, is mm-hmm. that you can run the same code on the client as on the server.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's not necessarily just a thing you do at all. So Meteor is kind of like this system that allows you to actually do that. So you have the same database client, like, actually in the browser.
Yeah,
that
see,
you
I think
do.
The pitch is bigger than that. It's like, we want to build a foundation. It's like, sorry,
yeah.
we have Unix, you know, and it's like, and then the web came along, and that was a foundation we could build on, right? HTTP. And it's
yeah.
like, all right, so what's the next, like ratchet up the foundation? You know, like, what's the next foundation?
But then they go through that, and they have, like, it's all built in real time and
exactly.
they have latency compensation.
Exactly.
So if you like reorder things in a list, like it'll, mm-hmm. it'll work instantly for you, and over there
mm-hmm.
it happens. And, it's just, and if you refresh the page, just the way it was. And
yeah,
it's
yeah.
a really cool.
I mean, there's
idea.
A lot of smart folks working on it. You know,
yeah.
and they've got
and they just got
credit.
A lot of funding.
Yeah,
$10 million.
Just got 11.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm very skeptical if it'll anything will ever come of it, but
dude,
I love the
it
vision.
Was, yeah.
It demos well.
Yeah, very
yeah.
very well. You know,
yeah,
as soon
yeah,
as you
I'm,
think,
I'm,
like, how is this using authentication?
I mean, they're trying to build this platform,
yeah.
you know? They're trying to build this platform that then whole ecosystems can build on top of.
Here's the thing, though. So much of success in technology has nothing to do with the actual technology itself.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but the marketing.
It's timing and...
Yes, the timing, and you get these tipping
quirks,
points
yeah.
when all of
yeah.
a sudden...
Being at the right place at the right time.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you look at even things like Django, you know, would Django be where it is now if Guido hadn't made... That remark,
sure, yeah,
offhand
exactly.
remark
yeah,
in
yeah,
2006.
Yeah.
And seriously, those
yeah.
sorts of things make a huge difference, and so it's really difficult for me.
Aging
it's
Malcolm
difficult
Lever,
to
yeah.
make an assessment based on the technology
right.
alone, whether something's gonna.
The thing that
be
I don't, the thing that I have a hard time with Meteor is one language.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
like if you're really gonna have Unix, like you need this, it needs to be much broader than.
Can you imagine having Python? You just write it there, and it works on the client too. That'd be incredible.
Yeah. You know,
yeah.
Yes.
I'm excited about what they did in particular is they, you know, they got $11 million in funding to work on an MIT project, license project. That's, can you imagine
yeah,
getting
yeah.
$11 million to work on
yeah.
on PINX, like,
yeah.
or requests, or GitTip?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah, it's ridiculous.
It is.
It's awesome. It's amazing.
Well, see, so my take is that we've already got this gift economy, you know? It's like we've already got this world in which,
Kickstarter's
you know, lots
good.
Of, what, yes, that, but, you know, just the whole startup world where there's, tons of money, you know. It's like it's. I don't. It doesn't seem to me like it's hard to get money to work on fun stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like if you're smart and you move to the right city and talk to the right
people. If
you
think
you know
about
I mean?
It, you can probably.
So it's like there's already how many jobs are there right now that are just running on venture capital? You know, I don't know. It, yeah. So how do we take that and make that available to as many people as possible. All right, so talking about the future, like how do we take that startup dream of like, all right, I'm going to work real hard for 10 years, I'm going to get $11 million, right, and I'm going to fund this company, and I'm going to build this cool thing, and then I'm going to be able to, you know, to control my own destiny, right, and to do what I want, to work on the projects that I want. It's like, what I want to see in the future is everybody being able to do that, you know?
Right.
Like, I hate cubicle jobs. I hate, like, sitting in the cubicle and surfing Facebook. Like, how evil is that? You know what I mean? Like, how evil is that, you know? Like, so how can we kill that? That's what I'm trying to do with the Intiv in the future, is kill Facebook surfing in cubicles.
How about just kill cubicles?
Yeah. Okay, sure. Yes.
Any favorite things that you guys saw here at PyOhio this weekend? Bring it back around.
The keynote was good, man.
Thank you.
So,
thank you.
Kenneth, I have to give you all the props in the world for putting up with the amazing AV disaster show.
It was like the universe didn't want me to finish my talk.
Yeah.
With the lights. You got your laptop back, right?
I got my laptop.
I don't think I handed it back to
you. And Mike, you got your...
Yeah, I got my dongle back. Yeah. Thank
you. Oh, that was yours?
Yeah. Yeah, my dongle was very busy this weekend.
Yeah, the lights going on and off, and the all the images, because I moved it to another laptop.
Right.
Well, it started with this weird thing that I could see what was going on, but everyone else seemed to think it was a problem with the connection.
Yeah, it wasn't.
And it wasn't. It was just that
the projector
was grabbing one frame, and then just...
Saying goodbye.
And it seemed to be an operating system issue, right?
Yeah.
Because you weren't the only one that had the problem. There's
a couple
others that got problems.
And I just updated to 10.8, so maybe
I think it's a 10.8 issue.
I'm thinking it was... when I was switching through the different resolutions and timings, you know, the hertz, it wasn't blinking my screen, so I'm thinking it was stuck at a hertz that was incompatible with
Kenneth,
the...
There's something to sticking with.
Well, the other thing
the stable technology.
10.8 is a more stable version of 10.7.
Yeah.
It's
okay,
even numbers.
10, 6,
the even numbers, that's why. The even numbers are the keepers.
10.6.8.
The odd numbers are like the unstable...
It's like the Linux kernel.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. The one thing that seemed in common with a lot of them was that people had mirroring on.
Yeah.
Because I don't have mirroring on. I have my set to have a second display,
mm-hmm.
and it just worked.
Yeah.
So...
Well, Apple's trying to fix that by doing their little air display thing now.
Yeah, that's going to be pretty
nice. All the projectors will probably have it built in or something.
In like 20 years.
Yeah. What was the thing, right? If you look at how many different adapters you've gone through, how many different plugs you've gone through on the laptop side versus
the video.
It's all
VGA.
You know, you sort of have a DVI to VGA converter, then a mini DVI
to
VGA converter.
VGA went into the standard library.
Exactly. VGA is sucking consistently for years to come.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, but it's been reverse engineered now. I have a boxy box, and which is tremendous. I love it. And one day I noticed on my iPhone I have this little box. I click on it, and it says boxy. I'm like, I play a YouTube video on the TV.
Nice.
Yeah.
Do I think the best thing about this
Apple
was
going to release it, but they didn't.
Yeah.
So, but they reverse engineered it. So.
Yeah, it's been really fun for us at home. My wife will take video on her phone of like the kid doing something cute, or you know, a ballet performance that I can't make it to. And then we just watch it on TV. Like, wow.
You use the
Apple
TV for Apple TV?
Yeah.
What were we going to say?
I was going to say the best part about PyOhio was this. It's hanging out.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Talking with you.
The hallway track is always...
The hallway track.
Yeah.
Yep.
You know, finally shaking James Talbert's hand. How many years of watching him put out new projects every week.
Skirting the policies about code of conduct while playing Cards Against Humanity.
Oh, that was amazing.
That was fun. That was last night.
It was tremendous. I got on the waiting list to get the game now.
Awesome.
I guess it's high demand.
Yeah, they keep selling out, and then people buy them and resell them for ridiculous sums of money.
I love the about page. It was like, will you ship to my inferior country?
Board games. That's another one I need to add to my technique.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah. So for years, I've been to PyCon, and I keep thinking, wow, I should go to that gaming social, because that looks like so much fun. And then I end up having dinner with people instead, and going out and doing stuff, and it never materializes. So like in 8-9 years of going, it's like, nope. And so it was a nice like little slice of that this time, maybe, to try that out.
I've been really into synthesizers lately, and like retro video games.
Right.
I've always been into retro video games, but I have like I'm starting to collect all like I you know I was young I used to like sell them for other games and trying to like rebuild every game I've ever owned.
That undersea synth game thing, I'm trying to remember the name, but you I think, linked to it.
Oh, that was amazing. Yeah, they're microbe. Yeah, yeah.
Like little microbe creatures, and you like add little stuff to them, and they like wiggle around, and then like the closer they are to the center, the louder they are.
Yeah,
and
you can
pick them up and drag them around, and kind of fight with each other.
That game has killed a lot of time.
Yeah,
and it does. Yeah, that's amazing. I love that.
You can come up with some pretty great stuff pretty easily.
The synthesizer stuff blows my mind. And to me, it feels like getting back to that old, the old assembly program where you can put it all in your head. If you have like a simple engine that creates sound, and you can just program it, essentially.
So what did you come up with Google's Moog Doodle?
Yeah, I just messed around with it. But that was amazing. Like, that stuff, I love that. It's just like programming. It's just you have functions and you're changing parameters, and they're even called parameters. I mean, it's very one-to-one. It's pretty awesome. It's fun stuff. I wish I'd get like Python in the mix there, but
well, I've got a couple of projects you should check out.
I probably should. Does it involve C extensions?
No, not at all.
Oh, really?
No, Sebastian is I didn't talk about it in my keynote, but it's another one of my musical projects for basically doing algorithmic composition.
Awesome.
In Python.
And what's the like IO?
I mean it's not doing synthesis, so it's outputting MIDI files.
That's perfect. Can you make a stream?
I could, but then that would probably involve C extensions and stuff. Well, that's something you could contribute.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see.
It's on GitHub.
All right. You can help fund it with GitTip.
There you go.
Great. Well, I have to get going to hit the road pretty soon, try to get home, see my family. any last words while we're here? Anything you guys want to leave us with?
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. Great. Go to Pi Ohio next year.
Pi Ohio was awesome.
For sure.
By far the best local conference.
Absolutely.
Last question.
All right. We'll look forward to it then.
All right.
Thanks for sitting down with us. It's great.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Great day. And travel safely back to all the different places you come from.
From Python Import Podcast is released. Isn't that enough for you people? Okay, fine. It's a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 3.0 license. God. Our music is by Jonathan Colton. To learn more, visit his website at jonathancolton.com. For more Monkeys with Rocket Launchers, check us out at frompythonimportpodcast.com. And remember, kids, when you upload your brain to GitHub, be careful who your collaborators are. Lamity lame, fail, fail.
Great, that'll end up in an outtake sometime.